This is gonna hurt. It's time for the Suffering Podcast.
From the moment we are born, the clock starts ticking. We weave our way through this life trying to avoid the hazards. The looming specter of tragedy is always around the corner. The inevitable day comes when all our fears are realized. As prepared for that moment as you think you were, suddenly you understand that you are in a situation that has no playbook. The phrase, "What now?" echoes in every corner of your mind. The only chance for survival is to fight off the urge of hopelessness. You are of value to your family, and your true importance now shines brighter than ever, once it is almost gone. Now you must stare down the Grim Reaper, hoping that he blinks before you do. I'm Kevin Donaldson here with Mike Felice, and on this episode of the Suffering Podcast, we welcome James Gardner to discuss the suffering of prostate cancer. James fought a hard battle, but he survived, and he's here to tell.
Thank God he survived. He's here.
Yeah, that would be a suffering of a ghost. James, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Kevin and Mike. It's really nice to be here.
Well, I've been following what you do for quite some time now. I love your work and your History, Your Story podcast, and I think it's wonderful stuff.
Thank you very much. We enjoy doing it, my wife Kelly and I.
You had Mrs. C on, too.
Mrs. Cunningham.
Mrs. Cunningham.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Jeez.
Mrs. C.
Before we get into any of the fun here, let's give a big shout-out to our marquee sponsor. That's Toyota of Hackensack. We don't trust anybody, but we do trust them. So if you're looking for a car, go to ToyotaHackensack.com and let them find you a car. So, James, each week we take a question from our audience, and this week's question comes from Cellophane Mark. I love the social media names.
Oh, boy. I'm not even going to get into that.
What's your new definition of fear? Going through what you went through, I'm assuming that your view of the word fear has changed somewhat. So what is your new definition of fear?
I think dwelling on the fear is something that has is more my issue. That's what I'm more afraid of instead of hitting it head on. Frankly.
Prairie fire.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
prairie fire.
Yeah.
Mike, what do you think?
Yeah, you know what? I mean, I think my new fear this day is just society itself.
Yeah.
You know, the way the way things are today. You know, and one of my big fears is, you know, as you know, I went to the swearing in last night.
Mm-hmm.
Our good friend Bobby Crudell got promoted to detective sergeant. Congratulations, Bob.
Good job, Bobby.
But they were swearing in new officers. And it's very emotional, you know, coming from background law enforcement, seeing these young kids getting sworn in. I have like such a fear for them now because of the hatred for like law enforcement now. You know, it's
a changing world.
It is.
The police world.
It really is. And it's fearful every day of things that are going on now.
Now, is that new fear? Was it always there, but you just didn't recognize it because you were in the thick of it?
Possibly. Yeah. You know, I mean, how many times did you go to a call and it was a crazy call and you didn't think about it until you got back in your car and you said like, wow.
Holy cow.
Yeah. What the hell just happened there? You know, so when you're involved in it, you see a lot of fear stems from when you don't have control over something. You know, when we went to a call, we had control over what was happening. You know, my fear now for these new officers is I have no control over them, you know, and
can't even guide them.
No, you can't do anything.
You're an old timer now.
Yeah, you're a dinosaur.
Yeah. My anxiety since my shooting has grown exponentially. All right. So, you know, I just had an anniversary and the week of was always bad. And now as time moves on, it gets bigger and bigger. But I had to stop and through some serious help, I had to stop and start thinking about what I'm thinking. And I know that sounds like a cliche type of thing, but thinking about what you're thinking, it brings down the anxiety for a second. It's like, well, wait a minute. Am I talking about reality here? Or is this just something I'm making up in my head? 9 times out of 10, it's something I'm making up in my head because I always try to play chess and not checkers. When you play chess, you have to think 3-4 moves ahead. That's what makes a good chess player. But a checkers player can see it's move to move. And since my shooting, I've tried to be a good chess player, but it's been to the detriment of my own psyche because it's just raised my anxiety beyond levels
that I could possibly imagine.
Well, you know, overthinking causes fear also.
That's it. That's it, the crux of it right there.
Because you keep thinking things through, and now you're making up 10 different scenarios about one scenario.
When is it too much? You know, James, I want you to chime in on this one, because when is it too much? You want to be prepared, but you don't want to be irrational.
Yeah, I think what it is particularly with my prostate cancer, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, is that I started to dwell on it. I started to over-research it. I started to go online.
Dr. Google?
Yeah, Dr. Exactly. Google, you're going to die.com sort of thing, where you're looking stuff up and it's...
How many times did you look up the percentage of survival rates?
More times than you can imagine. Actually, my wife, Kelly, banned me from any websites about prostate cancer or anything like that.
Like nohope.com.
Yeah, it was. So when I said not dwelling on it, instead hitting it head on, you can prepare to some degree with knowledge, but at some point you just have to act and face it and not just be anxious about it, worried about it.
If you look at statistics information with different types of cancers, I mean, imagine being diagnosed with pancreatic cancer. If you were to go online and look at the statistics of pancreatic cancer, you're going to end up putting a gun in your mouth because they're not good versus focusing on the fight that's in front of you. You know, and I think that's the important thing there. Just focus on the fight in front of you.
Well, that's what I did, and a lot of the people who I speak with do the same thing, or are wrestling with that, frankly, in some cases.
But see, that's what we tend to do. You know, fight the fight that's in front of you. But we take on other fights while we're fighting that one fight. You know,
we got one hand holding the guy here when we're punching somebody on the side. Yeah, I get it. Hey, Mark, thank you so much. Cellophane Mark. Thank you so much for sending that one in. Keep sending in your questions, and we will try to get them on the air. So, James, we had this weird introduction through our very own Andrew Santiago here at A&J Media. That plug? I'll collect my check after the show. And he told me all about your show. I listened to some stuff, and you and your wife, Kelly, were kind enough to invite me out for coffee at the Caldwell Diner. The Caldwell Diner. And we found out that we had a lot in common. I know you're part of a certain church that I have some friends that are part of. You're big into the Grover Cleveland Foundation because, as we all know, Grover Cleveland was born in Caldwell. His house is right on Bloomfield Avenue.
Right there. Yep.
What a crappy location there.
Does he still live there?
Yeah, he does. He does.
He's getting long in the tooth.
No, his tumor still lives there. So, again, I'm going to whip out some worthless information.
Yeah, here we go.
Here it is. So Grover Cleveland had a tumor in his mouth and he didn't want anybody to know. So he went out on a boat and he brought a surgeon out on a boat to remove the tumor. He recovered. He was fine, but they kept the tumor in a jar. I don't know where that tumor is right now.
I think it's in a museum in Philadelphia. I may be wrong with that.
Gosh. Ship it off to another state. they ring the Liberty Bell with it now.
And I saw a picture of it. It's like a decent-sized tumor.
How the hell do you hide it, though?
He did. You know, I guess it's no different than today. The politicians only let you see what they want you to see.
Well, that's why I said, and listen, you can attest to this. I honestly believe there's a cure for cancer. No American president ever died of cancer. So you mean to tell me the air is that pure in the White House where once a president goes in, he's just going to be cancer free the rest of his life?
Don't worry, James. We have a tinfoil hat for you as well.
The Suffering Podcast is cancer free.
It's cancer free. Yes, this is a cancer free zone. Okay, so don't bring cancer in it.
Seriously, if you think about that, no American president ever, they either got assassinated or died of old age. They never came down with cancer.
Hey, you want to go conspiracy theories? Did you know in every city that Garth Brooks goes into, that two or three people go missing? Look at Tom Segura's page. He constantly hounds Garth Brooks and says, where are the bodies? I love conspiracy theory. It's awesome. So, James, tell us a little bit about yourself.
We got off on a tangent.
I know.
Oh, that's all right. That's all right.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? Where'd you grow up?
I grew up in New Jersey, northern New Jersey. I was born in Glen Ridge, lived a little while in Belleville, New Jersey.
That's down by me.
Yeah. And then we moved to West Caldwell, where, except for a couple other places. My wife and I lived in Bloomfield for a while. I've lived in West Caldwell since I was 5 years old. So we're talking 60 years.
That's right in my wheelhouse. They're part of my local.
Yeah. Yeah. And I actually, we live in the same house that I grew up in.
Really?
Yeah. My dad bought it in 1963 for $24,000.
Which was a lot of money.
Yeah. Yeah. It was about 2 or 3 years' salary. So yeah. it was a lot of money. So I grew up in the town. And
that's a great town to grow up in.
It is. I love West Caldwell.
I mean, it's a little overdeveloped now. But it still has, especially the back roads, it still has that small town feel.
Yeah. Well, we have more deer in our backyard now than we ever did before in my entire life.
I mean, I think that's the overdevelopment too, where they're pushing them into the residential areas.
Yeah. Yeah. They're all over our backyard. I hear about people who go out into central or Northeast Pennsylvania to go deer hunting and
just come to my backyard.
You just got my backyard.
Well, my friend goes deer hunting every year.
Yeah.
He goes out west somewhere and I said, and he'll come home and he lives right down the street from me. He'll come home and there'll be a pack of them on his front yard.
Yeah.
But the deer, you notice that the deer in Pennsylvania are a little different than the deer here because they'll hide their vitals behind trees. Here around here, they'll come up and they'll almost eat out of your hands. They got no fear.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, they use our property as a,
bathroom.
A place to use the bathroom.
A dumping ground.
A dumping ground, yeah. And they're not easy to pick up, I'll tell you.
Those pellets.
Oh, geez. Yeah. So, you know, you've lived there your whole life.
Yes.
And how has it changed there?
You know, it's really maintained that nice suburban, relatively small town
feel. Hometown feel.
Hometown feel. Yeah. My kids have grown up there. My grandson. One of my grandchildren lives there now, and we really enjoy it.
Well, you can't tell, but James just had a birthday. He's on the William Shatner regiment of youth because he looks better than both of Mike and I, and he's not that much older than you. I'm sorry to say.
We almost went to high school together.
You might have been a senior when you were a freshman. That's a possibility.
Yeah, it was a bicentennial class, 1976. And
eight years. I was 84.
Yeah. Big year. Yeah, so we love it. I went to school, undergraduate degree in history, which
makes perfect sense now.
Yeah.
People used to say, what are you going to do with that?
Well, start a podcast.
Are you a teacher or what are you going to do now? Well, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I ended up in business. I went and got my master's in finance. And later on, I got a master's degree in theology when I was in my 50s.
That's pretty good.
Trying to decide what I'm going to be when I grow up.
Still not there yet.
But that's a perfect example because I have my degrees are in English, English literature. Mm-hmm. And I became a cop. So just because you follow your path in college, it doesn't mean that that's where you got to end up.
Right. I mean, I was in finance my whole career. My wife and I started giving lectures in history just to do something that we love to do. Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I love it. My wife supports me with it.
Isn't that the way of most marriages?
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And we did that for a long time. But then after a while, my job got transferred to Connecticut. It was really a rough commute. I was tired. We didn't have time to do that traveling around giving lectures. So a friend of ours said, why don't you guys do a podcast? I didn't know anything about it. And
we still don't.
Yeah. You still don't know anything about it? Yeah, we've got the equipment. We might as well have been looking at the cockpit of a 747. We didn't know what we were doing. My wife, Kelly, learned the whole thing. She really, from editing to social media, I just do the interviews and I love it. And it was a COVID baby. It really came out of COVID.
Sounds like a familiar story, doesn't it?
Yeah.
So the funny thing is their show, Your History, Your Story, started about the same time. We started in December 2020.
Right.
And it was just one of those things like, you know what? I got to do something. Let me do this. And ours was an extension of group therapy. Right. You know, it was a catharsis thing that we wanted to get out and speak to people and have some decent conversations and have some fun. And enjoy ourselves. And
right.
And then it grows into a business. And then,
exactly. Now, ours started in October 2020.
There you go.
And we've had former mobsters. We've had homicide detectives. We've had presidential descendants. We've had Hollywood child stars. We had a former Munchkin on The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, that's cool.
College professors. We've had a lot of fun, and I have learned so much. I've read more books in the last 3 years than I probably did the last 10.
Yeah, it really almost like expands your horizons, you know?
It does.
You learn so much about so many different people from so many different walks of life. I mean, it really is amazing.
Lives that you tasted that you would never taste unless you were in this,
yeah.
In this situation. But it's a funny thing because you had this history background, and then you go into business. Was business like a means to an end, or was the love there for it?
No, I didn't. I shouldn't. I had some very good times in my career because I met a lot of nice people, really good people, good professionals. But finance and business was not my passion. History, the love of history is just there. It's been in my heart for a long time. And learning more. You know, not just what I learned in school, but learning from people, as Mike was saying, just the different people I've met.
Support for the Suffering Podcast is brought to you by Manscaped, who's the best in men's below-the-waist grooming.
Their products are precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. Manscaped Performance Package is the ultimate men's hygiene bundle.
Inside the package, you'll find the Lawnmower 4.0, Weed Whacker Ear Nose Hair Trimmer, and the Crop Preserver Ball Deodorant.
And we also got the Crop Reviver Ball Toner. This thing is a life changer. Along with that,
boxer briefs.
I'm going to tell you what, these are like high quality boxer briefs. And this is no joke. I'm not saying this just because really their Manscaped sent it to us. These are nice. My boys are going to be quite happy in there.
And you can't tell Kevin's wearing them under the table right now. And we also have a nice travel package.
Join over 8 million men worldwide who trust Manscaped with this exclusive offer just for you. 20% off and free worldwide shipping with the code TSP at manscaped.com.
Jesus Christ, that's a lot of balls.
It did have a value with people skills and I think my ability to study and concentrate and analyze things. I could analyze numbers like I could analyze people sometimes.
Well, that's so Mike and I have a leftover ability to read people, to read your body language, to know when you're getting uncomfortable, when you're anxious, when you're mad.
Yeah.
And it's the little cues that not everybody is going to pick up. It's kind of a byproduct of what we used to do.
Right.
So while I do still love literature, I do love it to this day. Yep. I loved being a cop, but, and people would say to me, being a cop was like, you know, well, you know, you feel bad that you wasted your education. It wasn't a waste. It wasn't a waste at all. I did something I really enjoyed for, you know, with my graduate degrees, it's like 6 years.
And you got to play football.
I got to play football.
And you got to play football.
And I got to play football. So it wasn't all bad. Did your parents support your love of history? Was that always there?
Yeah, my parents were both. My mom was from London, and she grew up in London during the Blitz. She was in the Royal Air Force.
Oh, wow.
My dad was in the U.S. Army. And he had been in Germany and Austria and Italy. And at the end of the war, he came back through London and he was at a tea party and he met my mother. And
so real quick aside on your father being in Italy.
Yep.
Did your father eat pasta?
My father was, his mother was more of a German type of a cooking person. Very solid, like potatoes or cabbage or
the reason
stuffed peppers person.
There's a reason I asked that, because my grandfather came back from Italy, and it took him probably 10 years to eat pasta, because in Italy, they hang the pasta to dry over the windows, and he says you could see the swarm of flies around it, and it just grossed him out.
Yeah, my dad hated garlic, so that was one thing. He did not want to, he could eat a raw onion, but he did not like garlic. And when he went to Italy, I think he told me he was 100 feet across the border in Italy when VE Day occurred.
Really?
So he wasn't really there too long to enjoy the food.
Now, are your parents still with us?
No. My mom died in 2006. Sadly, she had Alzheimer's, which was a very difficult disease for her, but for the family.
It's more damaging to the people around.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Because they really don't know what's going on, you know, and the family takes the brunt of that. That's a tough, tough disease.
Yeah, and it was tough on all of us because she was such a delightful person, just a big personality. And she loved history, and she used to tell me stories about the Tower of London and the Battle of Hastings and all the kings and queens and stuff like that. But you know, in the end, she didn't know who I was. So that was kind of a rough end.
I had a friend of mine whose mother came down with Alzheimer's, and he said, "May God strike me dead." He said, "I really just want her to die."
Oh.
Because she became so combative. She didn't know who he was.
Yeah.
You know, she'd call the cops saying he broke into the house and, you know,
yeah,
she was hitting him. And
to give a little window into that, have you ever woken up from a nap and had no idea where you were?
Yes.
It's disorienting.
Yeah.
It's confusing. It's like, what's going on? Or you wake up and there's a noise in the house and you wake up and you don't quite know what's going on.
Yeah.
They have that 24/7.
Yeah, it was tough. And she would smile and be kind to people. That was her old personality. But even when she didn't remember who you were, but she did live nearby us in a continued care facility. So we got to visit her all the time.
So going through your cancer journey and witnessing your mother get taken by Alzheimer's, if you were to make a comparison, which one is more devastating?
Oh, I'd say Alzheimer's was far more devastating because I have had so far a very happy ending to my story. But my mother did not. Yeah. And it was every bit as bad as they said it would be. The journey with mom.
It's a dying a little bit.
A little bit. Day.
Dying every day.
Yeah. Every day. Yeah. First, she started losing her keys. Then she would say, "Oh, you told me that," and I didn't. It was tough. It was really, then we heard, "Oh, grandma hit the curb today in the car." Or one time my mother came walking up our street with a bowl of baked beans that she made for a party because she bought it, went into a store, came out, and she couldn't find her car. And she walked all the way to our house. And that's when we knew we needed to take her for evaluation. So that was tough. She died in 2006, but my dad died back in 88. I was 29 years old, and he died from bladder cancer.
Wow. So you've had experience with cancer in the past. You've seen the damages of it.
Yeah.
And in 88, the cancer treatments have become so far advanced now.
Yeah.
You don't realize it because cancer's always been cancer.
Yes.
What kind of effect did it have on you as a young man watching your father go through this?
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks for asking that. At the time, my wife and I had two of our three daughters. They were age 2 and 1, just almost 1. And my dad loved them. He adored them. And he couldn't spend enough time with them. But he was diagnosed when he was about 68, and he lived about a year and a half after diagnosis. My father smoked. He was that World War II generation. You know, he smoked. He used to smoke Viceroys.
Oh, Viceroy. I remember Viceroys.
Probably no filters.
Oh, yeah. And then he went to Tipperillos, the plastic tip things, and he smoked those.
Thinking he's getting healthier?
Yeah.
Don't worry. I'm still smoking, but I use filters.
I'm cutting back a little bit. I'm using a filter.
Yeah. Poor dad. He had an ashtray in the living room. It was this black ashtray, and it smelled like, you know, a fireplace almost. And he would be smoking his cigars and his, but you know, I grew up around a cloud of smoke.
I did too.
So a lot of us did, you know, and he,
which is odd because did you have in your house growing up, the standing ashtrays?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. So do you understand now those standing ashtrays are extraordinarily valuable?
I bet they are.
Because they don't make them anymore. Nobody smokes in their house anymore. I don't know of anybody that smokes in their house in my neighborhood anyway.
Right.
And there was an old man down the street and he had them and I restored them for him. He goes, "No, you can have them." I'm like, "I can't take them. They're worth too much money, but I'll restore it for you." And that's what I did. I restored it. It's beautiful crystal stand pedestal, brass pedestal. It's gorgeous.
People use them, throw their keys in them now, you know, keep them by the door. That's where you drop your keys.
Now, I don't know if you ever did this, but every once in a while, when like nobody was home or whatever, I'd grab one of the semi snuffed out cigars and light it up and take a few puffs.
Ooh.
And I turned green, thankfully.
Yeah.
And I was never able to, I wanted to smoke because everybody did. It was
to
cool
fit in.
But it made me feel sick. And I thank God for that because I never could take to it.
I wasn't as venturous as you. My parents smoked Larks.
Oh, yeah.
And it was the Lone Ranger actually, he advertised for Lark. But I would never take a lit. I did that once, like a half lit cigarette, and it tasted so bad that I'm just going to steal
my
whole ones.
My mother used to smoke menthol.
Ooh.
Like Salem Lights. I'll never forget that.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Salem Lights.
Yeah.
No. Really? Well, she was trying to keep you from smoking. That's what she was doing.
Well, I was like, Jim, I grabbed a cigarette. I took a drag of it, and I got that, like, that cigarette high.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just sitting there going,
I could feel nauseous just thinking about that right now.
So your father having bladder cancer, when he found out, were you there?
Yes, I remember the day I found out. He had thought that he had prostate cancer or that he had a prostate problem. He was experiencing blood in his urine. My father was not a big person to go to the doctor unless it was something pretty bad. So he was, I don't think he told my mother much about it. And then all of a sudden, I guess he got scared and he told my mom, and she said, you gotta go to the doctor. So doctor was concerned, referred him to a urologist, and they did a scope or a scan or whatever they did. I don't remember exactly what it was.
I don't even want to know how they did the scope, because it's just too horrifying to think about.
It's too horrifying to think about it. But I was at work, and I got a call, and it was not from my mom. It was from my mom's friend who was with her. So that made me nervous. Well, my mom couldn't get on the phone. And they found a mass, and it was large mass. And doctor was very concerned about it. They did a biopsy, but they're almost certain it was bladder cancer at the time. And certainly it was. And from that point, I was devastated. My dad was older dad. He was 40 when I was born. But we were close. He was like Ward Cleaver. He was the dad you went to for advice. He was just a wonderful, wonderful man. And a big impact on our family.
Like the rock in your family too, brother.
He was a rock. He really was. And he just, he was very brave the whole time. But I was so devastated. I drove home right away to Kelly, my wife. And I told her, and she said, well, you better, why don't you get over to the hospital right away? So I went over, and he was just coming out of it. And my mom was very upset. And of course, you're hopeful initially that there's going to be treatments and things. But it ended up months of, they removed his bladder. They removed it and replaced it with a stoma. Mm-hmm. So he had it's called a urostomy. My mother had to take care of that and change it out, and not to get detailed, but it was messy business. And he had something called a fissure as well, and it got infected. And the poor man, he couldn't eat. He had to eat intravenously for months.
Wow.
So even though he wanted to taste the sensation of food, he couldn't do it.
Well, there's a dignity thing that's involved, especially you talking about your father being a World War II vet. He's of that generation. Because I saw that with my grandfather. My grandfather had cancer. The cancer wrapped around his jugular vein.
Mm.
So they had to remove a nerve. So it looked like he had a stroke. And my grandfather's a very proud man. He wouldn't go play golf at the golf club that he played at forever because he was embarrassed about the way he looked. Yeah. It's a dignity thing with that generation. They have to remain, like you said, your father was Ward Cleaver. They have to maintain that aura around them.
The tough guy syndrome.
Yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, yeah, it was tough. And they got him on this chemotherapy. And he went from, my dad was only about 5'6", but he was stocky. He was muscular and stocky. And he just got sicker and sicker and sicker. And he ended up down, the last time I think he went to the doctor's office, he was about 80 pounds.
Wow.
And he lost a lot more in the last couple of weeks too. So if he was down in the 70s, maybe he was a skeleton really. And, you know, I was the optimist. I was the youngest in the family. I remember calling the doctor and asking, doctor, he's not eating. He's turning away all the food. Can we do something? Can we put something in his intravenous to give him some nourishment? And he said, Mr. Gardner, he said, it would be like somebody putting rotten meat under your nose and telling you to eat it.
Yeah.
He said, he doesn't want to eat he's rejecting it. He can't. He said, we'll try to do some nourishment and this, that, and the other. And I said, is he dying? Yeah, you know, I was in denial. Everybody else knew who he was, and I did really. But I said, is he dying? And he said, yeah. He said, he's got about 3 weeks. And that doctor was almost completely right.
Now, do you think that there's, with the new treatments out there, they're saying that there's a certain way to extract cannabis oil that will that will eradicate the cancer from your body. I actually know a gentleman who does it. He's in Canada, and he'll give it away, but you got to go up and get it because not actually the truth is he's not allowed in the States because he got caught moving 30 tandem trucks of marijuana into the country. So he's not allowed in the country anymore, but that's neither here nor there. I'm not a big proponent of the new cannabis laws. It's just not for me, but there is some hope when it comes to cancer patients with that because it does stimulate appetite. It does show some benefit to shrinking cancers. Do you think your father, at least some quality of life? Because that's with 3 weeks to go, you're just looking for quality of life.
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't know much about that, the science behind that at all. I really haven't read about it. I do know that he started to drink like those high-calorie drinks.
Like the Ensures.
Yeah, and he could have a little bit of that. And strangely enough, my father was not a big drinker at all, but he could have a little half a juice glass of beer.
And at that point, you're like, yeah, have at it.
Whatever go right ahead. Yeah. Or drink. Yeah.
See, my mother was diagnosed with brain cancer back in 2011.
I'm so sorry.
And I mean, she was pretty much 4 months from diagnosis to death.
Oh.
So we didn't have that long prolonged thing, but we had it in an assisted care facility. And she didn't want to she went through radiation. She didn't want to do chemotherapy, you know? So she said, you know what? Just let God, you know, just let it take its course, whatever. Mm. Her friends were bringing her bottles of wine. She was sitting in an assisted care facility drinking wine. My brother's like, why is she doing it? Listen, she wants to do it. Let her go, you know.
Let her have some fun.
She's as much as you hate to say it, she doesn't have much time left.
Yeah.
So let her enjoy that time.
So the treatments for cancer are, they're a little archaic, all right, in my opinion. So radiation was developed, I think, in the 1830s, and chemotherapy was in the 1920s. And the statistics for cancer don't show all that much improvement. There's a little bit more improvement, but I think that's the surrounding medicine around it. So traditional forms of treatment, I'm not 100% sold on. I think there's something better. That's in my opinion. But then there's you. And you've gone through this traumatic experience with your father, which I'm sure left an indelible mark on your brain for the rest of your life, watching him pass, watching him go. And he's gone. You start living your life thinking, you know, was there something in your head thinking, okay, when's my turn?
Well, I was 29, had a young family. We still had another daughter coming along a couple years later. And I felt, you know, when you're young, you feel a little bit invincible. Like I've got a lot of time left. And I was just grieving the loss of my dad at the time. And my mom, thankfully, my granddaughters were there. My mom just loved having them around and they gave her new life. And that was wonderful. So just started getting on with life. I worked a couple of jobs. We had a new house and, we were just getting back to business again. I didn't think too much about my own mortality then. And I really didn't do that for a long time. I mean, my mom's illness we handled, and that was very sad, but I still felt like, you know, we're going to work. You're doing your job. You're raising your kids. The kids are playing sports. You're doing all that.
You're still young enough to be invincible.
Yeah, still invincible. You're absolutely right, Mike. That's the way I felt. Got kind of blindsided by prostate cancer.
But getting back to the social media question where you fight that fight in front of you.
Yes.
Your father was the fight that you had in front of you. You fought that. Then life is the fight in front of you with raising your family and trying to keep your wife happy, which is always a losing battle.
She's looking.
You know, I'm pretty.
She's smiling now, so we're good.
She's looking right now.
put the blinder on, Dave. Put the tissue on.
I'm pretty sure that Napoleon got pissed off, or Josephine got pissed off at Napoleon. So, yeah, I'm pretty sure that happened. So, when was your diagnosis with prostate cancer?
The diagnosis was officially at the end of March. End of March, early April of 2015. I was 56 years old. I wasn't quite 57 yet. And I had actually a couple years before, I got a little scare when I went for my PSA test. Yeah. The PSA is the prostate-specific antigen. It's just a blood test. We'll talk about that a little later because it's a lifesaver. It's a lifesaver.
Yeah, I go through the PSA tests. I get my blood PSA checked every 6 months.
I go every 3 months.
Yeah.
Every 3 months, I get blood tests and everything else and check my PSA level and all that. And
it's a big thing. That's the message I want to get across, how important. Yeah. But it came back a little scary. I went back for some additional tests, and it came back okay. It didn't seem to be the real McCoy. And then it may have been a couple of years later in 2015, I went to get a new life insurance policy, and I had a physical, and I had another PSA test, and it came back high. I had a very good urologist who really liked to play it safe. He said, I want to mess around. He goes, you're 56. You're still pretty young. He says, I don't want to mess around with this. So I went for some more tests, and then it was a little high. And he said there can be other things that can affect it. Even, believe it or not, spicy food can affect the PSA level.
I'm in trouble.
I'm half Italian, so, you know.
Yeah, or infections, things like that. So he says, we'll come back in a month. And when I came back, it was even higher. And it was, he said, there's definitely something going on. I had an MRI done. And actually, at this time, my oldest daughter and her husband and our one-year-old new grandson had just taken a job offer down in Austin, Texas, which was breaking our heart.
Yeah.
Because we're like this new grandchild. And we were all worried about that. But my daughter and son-in-law were down picking out houses or a place to live. And our grandson was with us. My wife and I were sitting at the dining room table, and we looked at my patient portal. And the MRI results came up, and it said, carcinoma, likely carcinoma. And my body just went like ice through my veins when you see that. And it really scared the bejeebers out of us.
And probably scared your wife more.
Yeah.
It scared her too. She was trying to be strong for me. We called a friend who was a doctor. We read it to her, and she said, yeah. Yeah,
that's your wife's like, who the hell am I going to yell at now?
Exactly. Exactly.
The kids are in Austin.
And I'm looking at my grandson sitting there, and it did occur to me, am I going to be around to see him grow up? And that was really tough. So the doctor spoke to us. He said, we don't know for sure unless we do a biopsy. Well, biopsy, fortunately, I was out for it. They put you out for it. Because it's they go in basically like with a nail gun.
They go in through and how they go in through the rear entrance. Is not the best in the world.
Moon River.
So before we get like the prostate, everybody's heard prostate cancer. Everybody knows what the prostate is, but very few people really know what it is. And all it is just a little thing that sits next to your bladder.
Yeah, it's a little thing.
It's a little ball.
It's a little ball. It's there, and it is, produces seminal fluid. Mm-hmm. That's what it does. But it's there for a reason, and your whole system is, it's used to it being there.
Yeah.
And that gets into what happens later. But we got the biopsy results. The doctor called me, and I picked up the phone, and my heart's racing. I knew the call was coming. He says, Mr. Gardner, how are you? And I thought, he sounds happy. This is good
this
news.
Is good stuff, right?
He goes, you have prostate cancer. And he was trying to keep me upbeat, and I just sort of halted, and I was leaning on the kitchen counter, and what does this mean?
Yeah.
What's
my prognosis?
First thing, you're right. Yeah. The first thing, Mike, I thought about, what are my chances here? And at this point, some percentages were thrown around about it coming back or what have you. And I was introduced to something called a Gleason score. Now, I'm not a doctor. I'm not an expert. Anybody who's listening to this, please check with your doctor. But my Gleason score from the biopsy was a 6, which is a lowest. It's like the lowest and still be cancer. It was still cancer. And
cancer is such a ugly word.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. It's dreaded C word.
You know, carcinoma, not a much better word, but it's still a better word. Like if you go up to somebody, hey, I got a carcinoma.
Yeah.
Okay. Versus cancer, because immediately when you hear that word cancer, your mind goes to the worst possible places that you can think of, you know,
it does.
And your initial reaction, you're leaning up against the thing. It probably felt like you got punched in the stomach.
It did. It was almost
kicked in the nuts.
Yes. Yeah. More appropriately. Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw cancer up close.
Yeah.
And
you lived it.
As horrible as it was to see my dad go like that, it still wasn't me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I still wasn't. You know, I had to be there for my family. I had to be there.
Because at that point you have empathy.
Yeah.
You know, you have empathy for your father going through. It's hard to watch anybody you care for pass away, but you don't know the feeling of it. Now, fast forward to the future, you know, almost 30 years later, you now have sympathy.
Right. I was really feeling like, a little nervous, like what does this mean? What are my percentages? And then when I mentioned, I think in the beginning about fear, my view of fear, I started to worry about what I was going to do with that percentage that I heard. More so than I was worried about what was actually going to happen. If I heard a percentage of it coming back, I was going to be laser focused on that number.
Yeah. So what was it? Back. What was the percentage?
You know, I don't fully remember. He threw some, it was very good odds because of catching it early. And the Gleason score indicated that it's the level of aggressiveness of the cancer cells. And, but there was still cancer and it was still in my body and something had to be done with it. And the other thing is I was relatively young to be diagnosed with prostate cancer. I was 56.
And but all these things are working in your favor, early detection, being young and a little bit healthier.
The low Gleason score.
They were good, except the being younger is, it has a lot more time to do stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so it can be
metastasizing.
It can do that.
Yeah.
It can, if you leave it alone, you don't check it, you know, it could metastasize.
Now your father would just put iodine on it.
Yeah. Oh, Mercurochrome.
Mercurochrome.
Oh yeah. That
was the cure all.
Pink stuff that burned and burned.
That was crazy.
They just put some Mercurochrome on it.
Rub some dirt on it.
I recently bought a bottle of that more as a joke than anything else.
Nothing like mercury and iodine.
Kills anything.
My father used to put that in baby oil and lay out on a beach with it.
Oh my goodness. That's,
yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So, yeah, being younger, they were saying, you know, I don't want to just leave this be. If I were 20 years older, they may have said, do, you know, active surveillance, I think they call it, where you just keep watching it and testing it, which is, it's a, you know, very legitimate way to watch it. But so what were the options? They discussed a few things with me and, we decided, you know, he said surgery would be one thing. Radiation kind of got taken off the table for me. And I think some of that might have been the fact that my father had bladder cancer. And if you're radiating that area down there, I don't know if that, you know, that could have been a reason that they wouldn't want to zap me with radiation in my 50s and then in my 70s or 60s end up with bladder cancer or something. Mm-hmm. But it was really off the table except for surgery. Or I could wait a little while, but you know, that would be, he said to me, by the way, it all depends on you, whether you want to wait or not, because you got to decide, is it worth it to you? Like, do you want to get another, do you want another year of feeling normal? Like you know?
Well, you haven't felt any symptoms at this point.
But no. See, I was going to say, isn't that weird to put it on someone who just got told that they have cancer? Now, listen, ball's in your park now.
You know, yeah, I know what you're saying. I think, but he gave me an informed choice.
Yes.
Like you can, if you wait, the benefit is you keep your prostate for another year or two. If you know, that's if you wait. If you don't wait, you know, you're going to, you know, you're going to go through that discomfort. But if you wait, there's also that chance that it could jump to a higher level of aggressiveness.
Well, people have told me who have had prostate cancers. One of our good friends, who you know who I'm talking about, had prostate cancer. Mm. And the discomfort that he went through was, it sounded awful. And the main discomfort was he couldn't urinate.
Yeah.
And just imagine, I mean, we've all had full bladders from time to time, how uncomfortable that is. Well, that was him all the time. And he just, you know, he couldn't go. He would just sit on the, he would sit down on the toilet because he knew it was going to be a while.
Men often in their 50s and 60s start to get it's called benign enlargement of your prostate. It's not cancer, but you have trouble clearing your, emptying your bladder. And that can be a benign situation, but very uncomfortable.
Extremely uncomfortable.
I had that, and then I also had cancer on top of it. And I don't think it was the cancer that was giving me the discomfort at that time. It was more the enlargement.
The enlargement, yeah.
So I get this news. When I mentioned to you about being a worrier and just overthinking the fear of overthinking my odds and all that. I mean, my wife Kelly and I looked at each other and I said, I am not leaving this in my body. I can't do it. I was more afraid of me overthinking, and the quality of life would have been horrible. So
then you'd have this specter on your back constantly with this looming darkness. You knew it's there.
Yeah.
I don't understand. Aside from keeping your prostate, which, you know, sounds great on paper, but having that, I don't think I could bear that.
Even like going to sleep at night, you're thinking like, is it moving? Is it going?
Yeah.
Is it, you know, you're is it right, jumping around? You know, every time you put your head on the pillow.
It's like an earwig, you know, it's in there.
It's in there. It's like tunneling through your brain.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah, it was so, knowing it was there, not actually feeling it, but knowing it was there was just something we couldn't deal with. So we went into action. We said goodbye to my daughter and son-in-law.
Oh, I thought you were going to say goodbye to your prostate.
I said goodbye to the prostate soon afterward, put it that way. Say goodbye to them. But then we turned and focused on the next thing that we had to do. And what we wanted to do was the first thing I wanted to do was get into the hospital locally and get a surgeon locally and just get it done. And it turns out at the time we had a good friend who's, his brother had been on the staff in the urology department at Johns Hopkins, which was like one of the really top-notch hospitals. And we got the name of a surgeon who was very, you know, very well-known and very good. And we went down there. We drove down to Johns Hopkins, and I was going for a second opinion. And we're about halfway down, and Kelly says, "This isn't a second opinion. It's where you're going to get the surgery done and a second opinion."
Well, she was probably tired of stopping every rest stop because you had to pee.
A bunch of full bottles in the back of the car, you know?
this makes the decision-making so much easier.
I'm not doing this again. I'm not stopping 50 times.
Can we please just go down to Atlantic City without stopping four times? That's all I want.
Hanging it out the window.
Oh, yeah. So we went down to Johns Hopkins, and we had they looked at the slides from the biopsy, and they said, you know, they looked at my PSA score, and they said, we agree with the urologist that you should have the surgery. So we booked it May 7th, 2015. And so I went home, and then I had to go to work for like a couple weeks. Yeah. And you can imagine how productive I was at work.
Did you tell anybody?
Yes.
You did?
I'm not somebody who, obviously I'm talking about it on a podcast, so.
It's not like it's a secret anymore.
But a lot of men don't want to talk about it, you know.
I don't know.
It's that feeling weakness, you know, you don't want to show signs of weakness.
Yep.
Knowing myself the way that I do, I would probably not tell anybody because it's my worry.
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. And I do understand that. I just, you know, I didn't broadcast it generally, but some people at work knew about it. My boss, my boss's boss.
What was the reaction?
Oh, it was, so-and-so had it too. I know somebody's going through that right now. So it was like, yeah, we know somebody. Mm. You're not the only one, James. So it turns out at the time, a colleague, an older colleague, he had gone through prostate cancer, and he became a mentor to me, which is kind of part of my story about trying to do the same thing with other people and helping them. He told me about what he went through. It was similar. And he sort of was there for questions because I didn't know what was going to go on.
Well, it's that sympathy versus empathy thing. Yeah. It's great to have empathy for somebody in pain, but having sympathy, now that releases, that puts your guard down. So it allows you to open up a little bit more.
Yeah. You know, me and Kevin went through similar things. You know, when we went through our incidents, you don't feel better until you talk to someone who's been through that already.
Right.
You know, someone who could open a door for you and let you know, you're going to feel this, you're going to feel that, you know, because all these feelings are new to you.
Yes. Yeah. And the people were saying, you know, but people have different experiences with their prostate cancer, which we'll talk about in a second, but you're the only one in the end. Like you get people helping you, but you're still dealing with it.
Yeah.
And I had that 2 weeks and my boss and the management team where I worked were very kind. They knew I was struggling with this.
Did they tell you you had the good cancer?
I did have some people tell me, some very lovely, nice people.
Oh, you're lucky you have that cancer.
Oh, yeah, I feel lucky.
They're trying to tell you to feel, don't get too scared.
Listen, I wouldn't be lucky with the lottery. I wouldn't be lucky with cancer.
Yeah, I wasn't lucky. It wasn't a lucky thing. So we went down, and Kelly and I went down, and she stayed with me. The night before, we stayed in a hotel across from Johns Hopkins, and it was May. It was the end of the college school year, and there was a big group of partying students in the street beneath our hotel. So here I am, ready to go under the knife, lose my prostate. And I'm hearing all these young, lively kids celebrating and having a great time outside my window. I said, this is awful. This is terrible.
A terrible curse.
They were all smoking pot with Johnny Hopkins and drinking with Sloan Kettering.
Oh, they were just.
As long as your doctor wasn't down there with them drinking.
They were there till like 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah.
And we went and I had the surgery. And, you know, it was over the next day. The surgeon was. You know, he was happy with the results. And I went home. But unfortunately, because of my physiology, and it's very unusual that this happens, but I had some complications that required me to stay on a catheter
for
6 weeks. I had some issues because of my particular physiology, and I was trying to overdo, because you put on a catheter afterward. And usually it's like 10 days to 2 weeks. I was, when they took the catheter out initially, I strained too hard trying to control urine flow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Sorry to get graphic, but that's one of the things that happens when you get out. So I'm trying to, and I strained too hard and something
burst.
Went. Yeah. And they had to put we had to drive back down the next day and put the catheter back in. So I had it 6 weeks.
I've done that before, but I usually burst an eye blood vessel.
Oh, but
listen, it's the only way what I found, it's more about your mental state and how willing you are to fight. Because if you don't have that fight in you, I mean, we've seen it with police where we know police officers who have gotten shot in the chest and survived, and other ones who've gotten shot in the finger and died because it's, oh my God, I'm shot, I'm going to die, and they bleed out.
Yeah.
So your mental state at this point, what's your mental state like?
I was in such discomfort. Anybody who's had a catheter,
I'm sure
it's uncomfortable, and your whole system is whacked out. Anything you're used to doing, you know, sleeping at night is uncomfortable. Only briefly took some pain medication. Then it was just like Advil or whatever else I was taking. But it was just so uncomfortable. And I kept looking at that bag that you're looking at, and it was red, which meant there was still some blood. I knew I wasn't getting it out till that was clear. And yeah. It finally did clear up. We went down. They did an X-ray type of a thing, and they found out that I still had to go back for another, put it back in, leave it in for another couple of weeks.
Yay.
Yeah.
And I started feeling really sorry for myself. My middle daughter at this time was now getting married to a guy, our son-in-law, who was in the Air Force, and she was a homebody. She was always around home. She was also leaving us. So they were getting on with their lives. You know?
You should have played the cancer card on them and said, come on, man, I got cancer. You got to leave me too.
Yeah. So my wife was taking care of me, grieving our grandson being down in Texas, and, apologies to my family down in Texas, cause they're now back up in West Caldwell, New Jersey. Yeah. Thank goodness.
Everybody comes home.
Yeah. But she had that, plus she was planning a shower and we were planning a wedding and all that. And I just felt weak. I initially lost a lot of weight. But the good news was when the pathology came back on the surgery, that's when they really know what the stage of cancer is or the type of cancer. And it was consistent with the biopsy. So it was still a less aggressive form. But it was a matter of, like, when you do get the catheter out, by the way, I lost most of my urinary control. And so,
Did you have to wear like an adult diaper?
Depends. Yes, I did.
Holy cow. I did. Yeah. So that indignity that we were talking about with your father, I don't care what kind of man you are.
Yeah.
You strap on a pair of them.
Yeah, it was rough.
Yeah.
It was rough. And it was just, my wife would take me out for walks. I'd walk around the street. Neighbors would bake us bread. And, Kelly went out one time. She had my neighbor come over and sit with me. There are so many people came around us. It was just wonderful.
But to me, that's
a great gesture.
Yeah.
I don't want people doting on me though. You know?
Yeah.
You know, you want people around you, but maybe it's the machismo in us as guys, you know, where it's like, let me be.
Yeah. I mean, to me, well, Kelly will tell anybody it's I like the attention.
So that was right up your alley then.
Yeah. I enjoyed the seeing people, you know, and as much as I felt lousy, it was somebody to talk to. I did a lot of reading and, I wish I listened to podcasts back then. I didn't, you know, I was doing a lot of reading, but it took time and, eventually it healed and it took a while to go back to work again. I think I was out of work like 6 weeks because of I couldn't go to work with a catheter,
yeah. You know?
But you lose urinary control and.
See, me personally, I would go to work with a catheter in and I would hang the bag on the outside. Because I don't really want anybody around me.
Yeah. Well, that would do the trick.
It's like, hey, just whoa.
Swinging it.
You know, you go up to shake it. Whoa. I'll see you.
Here, yeah. hold this for me.
Yeah. Yeah. Can you give me a hand?
It was it was tough. But getting the good results back and then going for checkups. And they start doing the tests on the PSA again because they want to make sure it should be non-detectable. When you've had your prostate removed. So there shouldn't be any statistical indication it's back. And I was going initially, I think, once every 3 months, then it was 6 months, and then a year. We did have 1 year. The lab report came back with a detectable, which scared the living daylights out. It was about a year afterwards, I think. And we were terrified. And I was terrified. Kelly said, call the doctor and see what he says. And he said, listen, it may just be a false positive. False positive. Yes, exactly. A false
spurious
positive.
Spurious reading.
Yeah. A spurious reading, whatever. And, but we can't do it for another 2 weeks. So that was a lovely 2 weeks.
Sure.
Came back non-detectable.
You may have
a lot of prayers there. A lot of prayers.
You may have cancer. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
We'll see you in 2 weeks. Yeah. Have a nice day. Yeah. Just try not to think about it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Now, what is the long-term effects of this surgery that you went through?
There are sexual side effects. there are urinary side effects, both of which, particularly the urinary, comes back faster. And that's very, you don't realize how important normal functions are to you. You take them for granted.
Absolutely. Yeah,
because it was very difficult. And when I started to get that back, that was a big plus. And the other takes time.
Side effects suck, but at least you're alive.
You're alive, exactly. and they get better. They improve.
As long as one of the side effects is still breathing.
Yes.
Then
yes.
That's a perfect side effect.
Absolutely. But I lost a lot of weight after the surgery. And then I put on a lot of weight. And I had to lose that. So that was the way it went. But
you don't recommend the cancer diet.
No, it was a big surgery. Even though by the way, I didn't mention it was robotic surgery.
Oh, like a LASIK type of thing?
Well, they use this machine. They do a bunch of small incisions and they go in with this. It's actually a robot.
Yeah, and the doctor just sits behind like a computer.
Plays
a video Nintendo. Game.
Joysticks, yeah.
And they do a miraculous stuff and they did all that. So the healing time compared to what it used to be is incredible. From what I heard, like my grandfather had his prostate removed probably 60 years ago and they were devastating surgeries back then.
Right. Almost barbaric compared to.
Yeah, compared to now. Yeah.
So you use like a hammer and chisel back then.
Hammer and chisel. And I, you know, but I mean, I did have the complications and that was difficult, but I ended up doing fine. And I can't even see where the incisions are anymore, which is really terrific, you know?
Now, what kind of perspective has this given you on life moving forward? Are you willing to try new? Obviously, you're willing to try new things. You started a podcast, for God's sakes.
Yes, I'll tell you. There's an unfortunate thing that happens with people like me who tend to suffer from anxiety, is that you think that once this is solved, you're good. You'll never worry about anything trivial again. Well, initially, it was like, thank goodness, you know, it came out okay. Yeah, but what if it does come back?
You always have the Grim Reaper.
Yeah.
What if something else comes back somewhere else? You know, if I got it once, what's the chance of me getting it twice?
What fun would life be if it's always a sound effect in the back going, wah, wah, wah.
Exactly. So I started getting online because I got different pains here and there. I heard somewhere once you get cancer that, you know, you're more likely to get
the rate. The rate goes up. Yeah.
Whatever. I don't even know if they were real statistics, but yeah, I started doing that. So that was a little bit of a problem, but then something really good happened. And I say good, not in that. It wasn't really good, but it gave me sort of a purpose for why I went through this and what God really wanted me to do with it was to talk to other men who were going through it, or people who had a loved one going through it.
It's cathartic for them. It's cathartic for you.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. That's when I started getting people calling and saying, you know, this guy at church, he just got the diagnosis. He's scared to death. Can you talk to him?
Well, we certainly are glad that you're still around, James.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's an amazing story. And I think
we would have had an empty week if he wasn't still around.
So, James, I want you to give out some plugs. Where can our audience find you? What are you doing now? I know we got your History, Your Story podcast. You know, we got a big mutual friend in Charlie Cifarelli.
Great man, Charlie.
Yeah, he's a great man who, you know, talk about hope. That was my main job after Charlie had his medical issues, was to continue bringing him hope.
He is an amazing guy. And I just want to say one last thing about the speaking with others. I have made friends with some men who have had far more advanced and serious cases of prostate cancer that had metastasized, who are heroes, absolute heroes. And I can't say enough about them, but it's a privilege to walk alongside them. And, you know, I know a little bit about what they went through. I've been very fortunate with my outcome, but I just want to tell men out there, particularly if you're in your 40s, 50s, get that PSA done. talk to your doctors, get that test done, because early detection is so critical. And that's one of the main reasons I wanted to talk about this. And also, men, it's okay to talk about it. Find somebody who's gone through it. There's a lot of guys have. Talk to your doctor about it. Any concerns, if you had it in your family or you have a friend, talk about it. So that's what I wanted to say. But as far as that, Kelly and I, we love our podcast, Your History, Your Story. We're on YouTube. We're on most of the platforms, Apple, Spotify, others. Great guests.
Give out your social media links as well.
Yeah, can we put those in the notes? Because my wife Kelly would know them right off the bat. You know,
we'll put them all in your notes. I know you're on Instagram, Facebook.
Yeah.
What other platforms are you on social media?
Instagram, Facebook,
Twitter too, right? Or TikTok? Right?
Yes. TikTok. I'm looking at my wife now. She's
Let's just ask her.
Kelly, okay. Twitter. Okay, we're on Twitter.
That's good.
Snapchat. No, that's
TikTok.
We're all 40 years too old in this room to be on Snapchat. So that was a test.
What's the other one? Fans only. Only fans.
Yeah. So, listen, James, we're
Facebook too.
Facebook.
Yes.
We're coming to the end of this thing here, and we always complete the show because I believe that there's lessons in everything, even tragedy. There's lessons in. So you've gone through this amazing journey, prostate cancer, surgery, complications, losing your father to cancer, watching your mother die. What do you think that your suffering has taught you?
It's taught me that there's a lot of people out there who will come alongside of you and support you, even if maybe they haven't gone through what you've gone through. But people who have just that sense of helping others, there's more good people out there than you know about. And you'll find people, and you'll find colleagues, family members, within your own family, but also distant family members who maybe find out that you have this. Reach out, talk to other people. I found out that there's so many people who cared about me more than I ever imagined.
You know, we say a lot on this show. When you're going through that dark tunnel, right, you feel like you're all by yourself. Mm. It's so dark in there, you can't see the people that are standing right next to you walking along with you.
Well said, Mike.
Right. And that's true. You well think said. You're all by yourself.
Yep.
There's always people standing right next to you.
I was not by myself. My wife, primarily, she was with me. She put up with a lot of one quick thing. When I was one time, I had just taken a shower. And Kelly was helping me, and she got out the deodorant and she was going to hand it to me. And I put my arm up for her to put the deodorant under my arm. She goes, oh, no.
That's drawing the line.
I got to draw the line there. But a lot of good people that I found out were around there who loved me and were going to go to bat for me.
And they're good friends of yours now.
Yes.
People you probably would have never met if this didn't happen.
You're right. Right.
I couldn't agree more. James, I thank you so much for coming in, sitting with us, telling this difficult story, but I think it's going to do a lot of good.
Thank you very much, Kevin and Mike. I really appreciate being on your show.
Listen, it's a pleasure having you here and you opening up because you're going to help a lot of people.
Thank you both.
And that's going to do it for this episode of the Suffering Podcast, The Suffering of Prostate Cancer with James Gardner. And let's think about all the stuff that we learned today. Don't dwell on fear. Be the rock for your family. Statistics can be a blessing, but they can also be a curse. Feeling sorry for yourself does nothing. Side effects suck, but at least you're alive. But most importantly, support from others and supporting others helps you through the darkness. Don't forget, go to popple.com. You can get your digital business card. Put in the code TSP20 for a 20% discount. You can find us on all social media. That's Twitter, Facebook, Clapper, TikTok, Instagram. You can follow Mike at Mike_Falace. You can follow me at Real Kevin Donaldson. And of course, follow the Suffering Podcast. Don't forget, like, comment, and subscribe. And we're going to see you on the next episode.